Hey everyone, and welcome back to Lisa at the Edge. After a few weeks off, I am back with an exciting bunch of episodes lined up for y'all. First up, we have Chris Renda. Chris is the Director of Engineering for Azure Stack at Dell Technologies. In this episode, we discuss Dell's approach to co-engineering Azure Stack with Microsoft, where we look to add value, building a team to integrate tech and people, and what a monthly engineering cycle looks like. I hope you all enjoy, and I can't wait to share more episodes with you soon. Hey Chris, welcome to the Lisa at the Edge podcast. It's good to have you here.
Thanks, Lisa. I'm glad to have you here.
So Chris, you are the Director of Engineering for Azure Stack Hub at Dell.
And I am.
Yeah, good. That's always a good start. And we've got you on today to talk about engineering Azure Stack Hub, because it's quite unique, right, in that it's a co-engineered solution with Microsoft. Microsoft is a huge Dell partner, but it's a partner out with our sort of family. So really interested to hear from you on what that's like. I'd like to find out more about the Dell approach to that and what our vision is and where we think are the focus areas for us to bring value, because obviously we can't, that's prescripted in terms of where we can actually add value. And then I think what will be really interesting is to talk about how you built that co-engineering team, because you had to integrate people, which is always fun, and then you had to integrate tech, both from different product teams within Dell and with Microsoft. And then I'd like you to take us through what a monthly cycle looks like for you guys. So hopefully that sounds okay.
That sounds great. Sure.
Cool. Prior to getting into all that though, one of the big things I like to do on the podcast, and it's fast becoming my favorite part, is to learn about how people got into technology. So I just wondered if you could give a little bit of a background on how you got into technology and sort of a whistle-stop tour of your career so far.
Yeah, sure. So I got into technology fairly traditionally. I started college thinking I was going to be a chemistry science major. Came into that all raring to go, and just didn't work out for me. So I needed to kind of reevaluate about halfway through. And my father was always in IT, kind of from the beginning of IT. And I was always a hands-on kind of techie person, but it just never crossed my mind of something I wanted to do. But when I was faced at kind of reevaluating what major, what I wanted to get into, just seemed like kind of a natural fit. So I said, all right, let me give this a try. And I immediately had a lot more success with it right away. And it kind of just clicked. So I just continued on with that and graduated with an IT degree. And okay. Really rolled right into kind of was very lucky in that when I graduated, it was right around nearing the dot-com era. So it was very much a boom. So yeah. People were hiring all over the place. And I was really lucky I had secured a job with IBM 6 months before I even graduated. So I was in a really nice position. And it offered me something close to home, everything kind of right out of the gate, which was great. And yeah. So right out of there, I started at a very, obviously, one of the largest companies, IT companies you're going to find. And I learned a lot right there, which was, big companies come with some advantages. They come with some difficulties and things you have to learn. And as a, 21, 22-year-old and in the dot-com era, I pretty much wanted to move a lot faster, I think, than an IBM wanted to move me along in my career, which is a natural thing. But it was still, I did a few years there, really good experience and learned a lot, and then kind of rolled the dice and took my chances at a dot-com. And that was a great experience, right? Because it's something I was really fortunate to see in my career. It's something you may never see again, is some that kind of a boom, that kind of a bubble. Yep. So that was really exciting. I experienced the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. So yeah, I've seen it all. Yeah. I mean, I saw it at its peak where the things I could describe to you, you wouldn't believe, giving away cars on a quarterly basis for fun. Wow. to basically, monthly, quarterly layoffs where it was like almost a lotto. So yeah. it was quite the just difference in the way the world changed over really a year and a half time. But it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about just how to operate in a career, what's important, how to value yourself and things like that. I spent a lot of time, ironically, in doing Microsoft work now. I spent a lot of my career doing Linux-based work.
Okay.
So I spent Linux engineering was kind of my niche. I rolled into management, I don't know, somewhere around halfway. I mean, I'm nearing 25 years, sadly, in my career, but I'm rolled into management around halfway, and I was doing a lot of managing infrastructure, working in, you know, managing different, actually Linux teams, things like that. But I've worked on both the customer side and on the provider side. So while I've worked at obviously EMC, Dell EMC, like I said, IBM, I've also worked at .coms and a couple other startups. So I've seen what it takes in all kind of facets and different sizes of companies. And that's really helped me understand what it takes to be successful, where the pitfalls are. Not that I have it all figured out, but I've seen a lot of things over my career this far.
I think having that mix is really good experience. Having that appreciation of startups or smaller companies where you need to wear a multitude of hats, but it also gives you that sort of big picture view and you understand how teams, et cetera, interact with each other. I think that is invaluable. And then, like you say, bigger companies, they have their pros and their cons. Their cons can be sometimes they are just so big and they maybe move slow. But then their pros can be there's a lot more people, so maybe you can focus a little bit more on actually your role and sort of doing, you know, focusing more on one area. And I suppose what's been kind of cool about the Azure Stack product is that Azure Stack, new product out the gate, not that old at all, but doing that within Dell, massive company.
Yeah. So exactly, great point, which is the experience I've taken with me to date really helped in this situation, in that, like you said, Azure Stack Hub was a brand new product essentially. And for the last few years, it was very much like running a startup company within a larger company. So it gave, I was able to draw an experience to know how to operate. When do you need to wear all those hats? When is it time to grow up, right? There is a time, and we're kind of going through that transition now of we're you can't be a startup forever. So you need to integrate yourself into the larger Dell machine and leverage the different pieces and the shared services. But for a while there, it's all hands on deck. And that is not always comfortable for everybody. It's not always comfortable for me. But it's one of those things where there's certain things you must do to survive and to kind of reach the next spot. So yeah, it's been useful, especially in my experience.
Yeah. And I suppose that sort of all hands on deck mentality is, it can be tough, but very rewarding. And if you do it correctly, a lot of learnings to be had. And then it must be really nice to to have been there at that time, and then to also now be seeing the product mature, and like you say, we're growing up. I always think of, like, either whether it's a business or a product, we definitely go through those, like, teenage years, like pre-adolescent years, and then sort of it's definitely a maturity. So yeah, that's really cool. So Azure Stack Hub, for anyone listening who doesn't know, is a co-engineered solution, co-engineered by Microsoft and various OEMs. Obviously, Dell is the best, and we'll dig into a little bit why that is in this episode, I am sure. But that is pretty unique, right? You have to work with Microsoft, you have to work with Dell, other Dell product teams. So can you just give, like, a little bit of a description about what that co-engineering partnership looks like, what we can do as an OEM and what we can, and just the sort of the things that are involved in that setup that we wouldn't necessarily need to think about if we were focusing on sure. an all Dell solution.
Sure. So, like you said, co-engineered when we talk about co-engineered, we mean we essentially we're partners with Microsoft, and it's a one-to-many partnership. So as you said, there's multiple OEMs or partners involved here, and it's kind of interesting. It's like co-opetition, right? We're working together, but we're also competing against the other OEMs. But we all have an interest in bringing value to the product and bringing ideas and helping Microsoft make it better for all of our game. So what we work within certain confines. And so Azure Stack Hub is a closed system. So think of the software, the platform, that's Microsoft's, that's their IP, they own that. And yeah. As far as injecting differentiation, we're really limited in what we can do in the core software of Azure Stack Hub. So that forces partners and all of us OEMs to look at different areas where we can compete and differentiate. So obviously, first and foremost, Dell brings PowerEdge to the table, and PowerEdge being the best platform essentially for servers in the world is a nice bonus. You're going to gain customer share just on PowerEdge alone, right? There are customers that absolutely, that's what they use in their data center, and that's all they want to hear about. And so, great, it sells itself. Then there's other customers where they've got a mix. So, you know, PowerEdge is a nice talking point, but it may not sell the solution on its own. But obviously, we differentiate on our hardware. We also look to inject any of the Dell IP that we own collectively across the portfolio that we can bring to the table. So whether it be data protection, whether it be, you know, advantages with our management, Open Manage, our Open Manage Network Manager, our SAE Call Home, all those things we have tried to tie in as seamlessly as possible as add-ons to make a much more fully featured solution that works for Dell customers. So there's a lot of work there. And then what we've also done from a control your own destiny standpoint is Dell has taken the look at what's our best way to add customer value uniquely, and that would be in and around automation. And mm-hmm. So we've taken kind of two paths there. We've taken a deployment automation type of track where we said, okay, how do we make this easier and seamless, and how do we make this as simple as possible for this to get deployed in a customer data center?
Yeah,
it's fairly complex. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of prereqs. There's just a lot of work.
It's very different to deploying other infrastructure platforms that we've been used to, customers have been used to. Like you say, there's a whole section and phase of prereq work that people just don't really expect.
It's prescriptive. It's super prescriptive, which is not always comfortable for customers because they want to do things the way they've done it, and we're asking them to fit in this box, and that's a challenge. And so there's a lot of education that goes on with that. There's a lot of answering the question of why. But ultimately, we need the customer to fit in this box and answer a bunch of these questions and essentially bring the right data to the table. And so we've put a lot of work into the automation of this to make our services and support really seamless and repeatable, but we've also put a lot into the prereq process and the deployment, just the experience for the customer to try and make it more seamless. So we've done a lot of software development around that. And then our other track has been much more on the patch and update, right? Any large scale solution product, whether it be VxBlock, VxRail, everybody deals with patch and update, RCMs, everybody deals with that. So if you look at Azure Stack Hub being a young, early on product, patch and update's a thing, but it's very much a secondary manual thought. There's a lot of console time for customers, and it's not something Microsoft could focus on right out of the gate. They're focused on their core.
Yeah.
So we put a lot of time into building software solutions and componentry around the Microsoft patch and update process to essentially eliminate console time for customers. So instead of, you know, a patch and update process that might take over the weekend 12 hours or 15 hours where they have to sit in front of the console and babysit it, we have offered them the ability to click a button and much more automatic. It still takes the same amount of time in the background, but that doesn't mean you've tied up an engineer for as long. So that's a big differentiator that has resonated well with customers in the field as opposed to our competition.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that you said just at the beginning of this section was really interesting about the strange relationship that we're all in, because like you say, this is it's a Microsoft first product. It's their software, it's their platform, it's Azure in your data center. And therefore we are limited as OEMs in where we can add value and where we can differentiate. But we all have a shared interest of making it better, of making the product successful, of, yes, you know, enabling it to do what customers need it to do, to integrate into customer data centers that it needs to sit, you know, it needs to integrate into. And that's really interesting, because we do see OEMs taking different approaches in terms of where they're adding value, what form factors they're looking into. It's just a very unique space, which is interesting. But yeah, I think that Dell, we focus very much on the, like you say, the automation piece for both deploy and patch and update. And then also we've got preview programs right now in our roadmap around integrating data protect, etc. So understanding that hub is not an island within your data center. It is very different from probably anything else you have in your data center. And it's why you have to deploy it in this strict way, because it has to maintain consistency with Azure, etc. But we understand it's not an island within your data center, and it needs to be able to interact with the other infrastructures and data around it so that you can get the best out of it. So yeah, it's interesting that we've taken that approach.
Yeah, it's one of the few true clouds, right? That's the thing that I think people maybe don't always understand, is it's a true cloud. And it's as much just like public Azure or any other public cloud, only in your data center. And that comes with some rules and things that you have to follow, right? It's not a free-for-all. And there's things that companies need to understand when adopting a true cloud that they may not always understand right out of the gate, because much of us, including myself, have come from that. You come from that IaaS platform virtualization where you virtualize a bunch of hosts, you run a bunch of VMs, you oversubscribe resources wherever you want, and you get that sprawl. And really all that costs you is the resources. And in a true cloud, it's a little different. Obviously, there's meters are spinning for consumption. There is not the notion of oversubscription. You're fitting into different classes of VMs. And then there's the idea of how do you handle administrating, you know, the plans, the offers, the subscriptions that your tenants actually use.
Yeah.
So it's a model shift as much in technology, but in mindset and in management. And if you're, what we've seen is if customers aren't aligned there, it limits their ability to be successful, because it's not something. I don't recommend putting a true cloud in your data center unless you are going to manage it as a cloud. If you're going to just manage this as a same old IaaS box, yeah, you can do it, but I'm not sure that's the best way to really reap the benefits of it. So,
and that's really interesting as well. I think, like you say, because it is a true cloud, because your focus has shifted from managing the platform to running services within the platform. And actually you're managing the marketplace, offers, subscriptions, what people are consuming, that us putting the focus into automation is actually just aligned with what the product is. You know, if Microsoft and the OEMs want this to be the best that it can be in that true cloud native platform in your data center, you shouldn't have to have an engineer spend his weekend watching a lengthy update. The updates are lengthy, right? Because, you know, they happen monthly, and we'll come on to that and the fact that your team has to keep up with that. But they happen monthly, which, let's face it, is a lot more, what's the word? Regular than most people are used to dealing with in terms of managing infrastructure in your data center, right? So focusing on that automation is just aligned with what the product is and how people should be using it and how people should be viewing it. Yes, you've got to apply our updates and Microsoft updates, but they should be as seamless and as cloud-like as possible. Otherwise, you know, you're kind of confusing the goal.
It's a shift in, it's absolutely a shift in mindset and operation. Like you said, the old model of if it's not broke, don't fix it, don't apply updates. It doesn't really work like that. And as you alluded to, I mean, there are rapid updates, there are Dell updates, there are Microsoft updates, and the support policies dictate that you stay in compliance. Right? Yeah. Microsoft looks at an N-2 as supported. And so that's a lot different than customers who are used to doing updates every 6 months or once a year, or, you know, don't touch the firmware if it's not broken.
Yeah.
That's not this. And so, yeah, it's a challenge, and it's different for customers because they have to shift their operation. But you hit on something which is really smart, which is the value add here is trying to take all that lower level administration work away and make that below the value line. And you want to make the work that you're spending your engineer's time on and your customer's time on, you want that to be above the value line. And so you want that to be not on the lower level infrastructure. It's a buy it, don't build it situation, and let them focus on where they're best and let them focus on development and things that they're utilizing the platform for, not just upkeeping the platform.
Yeah, exactly. Because even though Azure Stack Hub only has a subset of the services that they do in Azure, even then the updates to those services and the things that you can do within those services, and even, you know, Azure IaaS is so different from IaaS you might get on a virtualization platform, that you really need, if you want to get the most out of those services and you actually want to be successful in adopting these services in this Azure or cloud model, you have to put the time in. It's an upskilling, it's a rethinking how you run your infrastructure. You know, do you want to embrace infrastructure as code? Do you want to start using some of the PaaS services like App Service, etc.? And also with the PaaS services, right, you need to build them, and you need to make sure that they are available within the marketplace and manage them as well. So yeah, you don't, if you had to spend your time, a lot of time managing the hub, it kind of defeats the purpose. And therefore we want to make it as cloud-like as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so when this all began and you had to build a team to engineer a product where you had to interact with Microsoft engineering, Dell product engineering with like PowerEdge, etc., and other BUs within Dell, how did you go about that, integrating both teams and tech? I know when we had a little bit of a pre-chat about this, we talked about things like a set of core principles, including agile, managing complexity, the different tools and processes that you've basically put into place to help both teams and tech come together to make this work, and like we said, on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
Which is pretty intense. I can
imagine. It is. It's a challenge, and it's a challenge that doesn't go away. So it's good and bad, right? It's a challenge, but it also keeps things fresh. There's always something to work on. So, you know, early on, as any other startup type of company, there are a lot of individual heroic efforts. And I think that was what we saw in the first year. Folks that were just really excellent at communication, excellent at kind of navigating Dell, navigating the different groups.
Yep.
There's a lot of that kind of work going on. But if you look at how the way we're organized today is still mostly how we were organized originally, but we've fallen more into our direct roles today. But if you look at my organization, obviously, architecture is a big part of it, and that's where a lot of our early on heroic efforts came from, is trying to put together what is the Azure Stack platform from a hardware perspective going to be. There's a lot of work that goes into that, because again, this isn't a pick and choose type of model with Azure Stack Hub. This is here are your choices, and they're very limited, and we did that purposely so that we could make sure customers got great service. It was repeatable. And we had to really make sure that the componentry we selected had the right lifespan and the right life cycle and serviceability. Yeah. You don't want to pick a component that goes, you know, out of serviceability within the first year. And that goes all the way down from the disks to the RAM to the network drivers, to the network cards. Everything in there was selected, you know, processors on its not only performance, but its kind of length of life. So
that's another huge area of value that we bring, right? And I think it's one that's sometimes overlooked or can be seen as quite challenging, because I think for Azure Stack Hub, you naturally have to be prescriptive in your configs anyway, but we are pretty prescriptive in our configs. But that's because the more flexibility you bring into this, the less like consistency and guarantee you can deliver to the customer. And and the thing is that you do not need 10 different flexible options if you understand the workloads that you're putting on top of Azure and why you're using Azure. If you make that, when I hear customers asking about, well, can we have this config and can we tweak this and we can tweak that, it's always met with a lack of clarity around the specific workloads they're going to be running and the use cases. And so therefore, they're worried. And again, it's maybe a lack of understanding, a lack of education, which is, you know, it's still so new. So they're kind of trying to, I don't really understand, but I feel like I need this, so I want it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's always met with that. Whereas when you spend the time, and I understand this can sort of not always be done, then, you know, it can't be done perfectly. But if you do spend the time to understand your workloads and your use cases, then the benefit there is you will be able to size for a hub within we do have a selection of configurations. And not only that, is when you buy into that configuration, we have built it with that use case or in mind. And not only that, we have guaranteed the supply chain, the support of that for an extended amount of time, because this is, like we've said a few times, unlike anything else in terms of consistency is so important from both a Microsoft and an OEM perspective. You know, consistency is the biggest thing in the public cloud. It's so important. So therefore, we have to be prescriptive in our configurations. And I think we spent a lot of time thinking about that, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly what you just pointed out is what I was saying, which is if a customer wants to get an expansion node 2 years from now, they'll be able to get it because we've ensured that the supply chain and the life cycles are all there. If we allowed customers to do what their first instinct is, which is tweak every single thing in it, then yes, we've created a bunch of different unicorn configurations, and they're going to be impossible to service later on, or it's going to result in extended service or just a really bad customer experience that they didn't foresee. So we deal with more of this frustration up front, like you're talking about, which is educating customers, making sure they understand why we've made some of these choices we've made.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is, like you just mentioned, is them kind of understanding what their use case is. And that is all part of this being a newer model. Not a lot of customers have experience running a true cloud in their data center. Everybody's dabbled, and the cloud word is always exciting. But to really do it, a lot of customers have never done it and never
there's
done
never
it
correctly. There's never been a true, and I might annoy some people, but there's never been a true cloud platform that you could run in your data center. The only people who have experience running clouds in their data center are Microsoft and AWS. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's
a whole new operating
there's model. People that will claim, there are people that will claim that OpenStack is true cloud and they've done it, but again, that's very roll your own. This is probably, like you're saying, this is the most mature, you know, taking from an established public cloud, which has the marketplace, has all of these things established, and then bringing it down into your data center. Yeah, it's very unique in that sense. But it's true, no matter what, very few customers, very few understand what it takes to run a true cloud in their data center. And you have lots of customers who are cloud customers, and they have lots of public cloud experience, and that's great. But in the public cloud, you don't play cloud administrator. You're a consumer. Here, now you're playing the role of creating, you're now Microsoft, right? You're playing the role of creating the plans, creating the offers, managing the subscriptions. That's new territory for everybody. So those are new IT roles as well within the organization that need to be created or need to be matured. Not everybody knows how to do it. So there's a lot of learning that goes on in the journey here. And so, yeah, we are trying to take some of the complexity out of it for customers. Some take longer to understand that than others. And that's kind of a natural thing because everybody wants to tweak the dials as their first, instinct.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so in terms of building your team, how that works, can you give me a little bit of an overview of how you're structured and how you guys interact and the sort of core processes you use to be able to manage this complexity?
So as I started to mention, we have architects, and we've evolved the architects' roles based on the needs over time. In the beginning, it was much more like hardware architect, software architect or platform architect, and we kind of had a networking architect position. We still have similar roles, but we've needed to mature them, if you will. So we've moved the one architect. Now I have a legitimate software development architect. I still have a networking centric architect. I have a kind of hardware platform architect, but they work much more closely together as a unit now, as opposed to having just strictly defined silos, because we've gotten to a point where we're just much more mature. That group is very instrumental in not only working with Microsoft on what's coming and what things look like, but also working back with our product management teams and understanding what their asks are in order to help define the future facing stories and features that they would like us to absorb. Okay. On the strictly engineering groups, I have really what I consider to be kind of a platform group, and they handle working with all the different, all the different platforms we offer. So when it comes to PowerEdge, for example, we do a 640, a 740, an 840 based stacks, tactical based stack. These are all things that the platform team need to validate and work against on a monthly basis. And you touched upon the cadence a little bit. Microsoft is on a monthly build process, just like Dell EMC is on a monthly build process. So Microsoft passes us code repeatedly during a monthly cycle. And they pass us, release candidate builds constantly. And what we do, just like all the other partners do, is we need to validate their builds on our hardware. And we need to pass back any defects, anything we find that doesn't seem to pass muster, we need to let them know and open up bugs and collectively collaborate, co-engineer, if you will, with them to resolve some of these things. And so my platform team is very dialed into the Microsoft cadence, working on all of those builds. They also, at the same time, will participate in testing and looking at a lot of the in-house software development that we do. So we tend to, during our monthly cycle, and we can talk a little bit more about it in detail, but we tend to morph into much more of a all hands on deck testing as we get toward the end of our monthly cycle. Okay. Because of the nature of how many people we have and what the requirements are to get a build out every month, we tend to focus very much on testing. So there's a lot of pivot that goes on toward the end of our cycle. So that's my platform team. I have a software development team, which is really what we talked about, the value added differentiation in terms of, deployment automation, patch and update automation. There's other aspects like we're doing security, drift, and remediation. There's a lot of different just differentiators we're looking for to stand out. And that's really what my software development team does. It's really pure software development, and they're creating tools and things all of the time. So that's that team. And then over time, so anybody who's familiar with legacy EMC would know the CSE term, which is corporate solutions engineer, corporate systems engineer, very much was a high value team for customers, field facing, kind of the bridge between core engineering and the field to help us get off the ground, if you will. And we've leveraged that in large solutions in EMC, like such as Enterprise Hybrid Cloud, all those. They use it in VxRail. It's a useful team. We've used that team early on very much for that purpose. As we've grown up a little bit, and the needs of Azure Stack have changed and what we need in, within our group, I still have sort of a hybrid team now, if you will, of folks that do some of that field-facing enablement and work with the field and our services and support, and then as well as handle a lot of the customer escalations that come up through our support channels. We handle anything that kind of hits beyond a level three, we'll take a look at.
Yep.
But we also leverage that team now to contribute back into core engineering componentry. So whether it's platform work, whether it's some software development work, or just leveraging some of our internal engineering backlogs, such as automation and things to drive us forward in our evolution.
Yep.
So those are the four kind of main components of my group. And we obviously work closely with engineering program management and then product management and a core team, just like a lot of others do in Dell.
Cool. That's actually the first time that I fully understood the makeup of that team. So that was actually really good to hear. Okay. So then how do you guys operate on a monthly? Actually, before I ask that, so you said that the architects worked originally in a bit more siloed and they've matured now and they work closely together. And at the beginning, there was a sort of hero mentality, which I think everyone who's worked in IT can recognize. I think that has it's got a time and a place and it's got pros and cons. How did you, and what were the main challenges in terms of bringing those teams together and maturing those teams? And how did you overcome those? Because when you mentioned that you had the networking engineers and the architect engineers and the software engineer, architect, I thought to myself, that's quite a traditional way of having them. But then when you said, you know, they have matured and they work a lot closely together, I was going to say, yeah, because one thing that's really different, I think, in customers struggle, or anyone adopting cloud native technology, whether that be Azure or AWS or whatever, is that the original teams that we've been so used to working with in IT don't really fit, right? They're not like a nice box. So you can start to deploy and manage virtual machines in Azure, but do a whole load of the networking. And the networking engineer's role actually becomes more of like this governance and framework role in terms of, and I'll use some Azure terminology here, but like resource tagging, how you basically manage the scaffold around the resource. They don't go in and do the specific networking things. Like the engineer who's creating the virtual machines or manage them, et cetera, the services actually can do a lot of that themselves. And so, yeah, when you said they've matured and actually they work a lot closer together, I just wanted to learn a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's a continual challenge I have. So first and foremost, my team is global, right? So I have from Bangalore to EMEA to the US, we have people everywhere. So first and foremost, you're dealing with different cultures, and that's always a challenge, and getting everyone kind of on the same page. Yeah. It's something that I'll never be done with that. That's something I'm always continually working on, and you're always managing and tweaking the relationships and trying to make sure everybody's on the same page. But I not only have a global team, but I have managed, all of my managers are physically in different places in different countries. So they themselves have different cultures to deal with just among that small group of managers. But as we've grown up from, like you said, from the hero or the I do everything myself, it's been interesting because when you first recruiting your original staff for kind of a startup, you need experts, and you need experts at what they do. So you need a networking expert, or you need this kind of expert. And so everybody, even though they're doing a hero type work, they feel like they have this is my domain, and this is what I do, and I do it the best. And as you start to blur the lines a little bit, it's what I try and do is I try to break down, and I every time I do kind of an all hands, I talk more and more about less silos and more one team. And obviously, you're never going to get rid of SMEs. You're always going to have people that are SMEs in certain areas. And if you came from networking or came from software development, like that's going to be your thing. And I get that, and absolutely want to respect the fact that you might be the ultimate expert in that area. Yeah. But I don't want that to be limiting to what you can, that shouldn't be the limit of your vision. And like you said, in a cloud environment, the typical IT siloed roles are not really useful anymore, because everything, it all needs to work together as a one cohesive system. So what I've tried to do is essentially, when we meet together as architects, for example, we talk about all of the different aspects that are facing us right now, any challenges, any of the work items, we talk about them collectively. And what you'll find is your hardware guy might have some very interesting input on a software deliverable, and the software person has a major impact on some networking deliverables and just perspective that maybe that person didn't think about. So to me, it's about kind of just bringing more voices into the conversation. And sometimes that works really well, I perfectly admit that. And sometimes it doesn't work as well as you want, because you're walking a line of trying not to step on people's toes about what they feel is their domain and where they're most knowledgeable. But it's a lot about building trust. And the more you can get people to trust each other, yeah, the more they feel it's collaborative and the less they feel it as a threat. And that is something any manager has dealt with before. It's not unique to Azure Stack Hub, but it's something that you just continually have to manage. And you have to always kind of keep an eye on the relationships and make sure that people feel that they're working in a collaborative environment. So what we've done is I try to bring as many voices into the conversation, and I encourage my managers to have a lot of dialogue with not only their staff, but with each other. Yep. So that what I find is the biggest challenges are when things get assumed or unspoken. It's, yes, it's communication, right? So, yep, so all of the assumptions get us in trouble. So, you know, an email, as we all know, emails kind of,
there's a saying, what is it? Assume makes an ass out of me and you.
Yes, as my mother would always say.
Yeah, that is the saying, but it's so true. Assumptions honestly can be like the like silent,
it is, it's
evil that just ruins everyone's day.
It's a huge challenge, and email is ripe for that, because email, you can't, you know, without being able to read tone, and again, different cultures, different way of, yes, phrasing things, different, yeah, email. So it's a continual thing that I spend a lot of time on, and I manage that closely. But, mm-hmm, I've just tried to bring, over time as we've matured, I've tried to take away some of the hero mentality, which is, okay, we're starting to grow up, so we need to fall into how a little more Dell normal is. Let's leverage the resources. I mean, that's one of the great things about a big company is there are an abundance of resources. Yeah. Like them or not, they are there. And so operating in a vacuum is not the best thing. And it's great for getting off the ground, but it's not great for sustaining your business. So starting to move people into leveraging the greater resources available to us, and then working much more collectively on not throwing things over the fence between teams. You know, just because we obviously we're one organization, we have different teams, but trying to limit the, I'm done with my job, I threw it over my shoulder, I don't know what they're doing. When I hear words like they, or I don't know what they're, like, I trigger on those things, and I try to stop that where I can. And sometimes you're successful, sometimes you're not, but it's more about kind of just breeding a consistent thought process over time, and then I think people adopt it. So it's been interesting.
People massively underestimate the value of bringing groups together to have collective discussions. Don't think in IT that necessarily happens so much, because, and I suppose because it is in the past, and because I don't want to say this, but maybe things haven't changed that much in some technologies, is that networking, storage, or you know, they are very prescriptive. This is what we do, and this is what we need other teams to do. Whereas when you are, I think that just people massively undervalue just bringing people together to, I mean, you would do it for any other business problem. You would do it for any other, you know, like if you had a specific problem in your job or in your family, you'd speak to your friends. Your friends aren't, yeah, in your family. They don't do your job. They might not be in your industry, but you have a chat about, I've got this problem. And, on one of my previous podcasts, we were talking about DevOps, And we didn't talk anything to do with technology or tools. We actually spoke about people and culture. And we spoke about the agile methodology and the whole stand-up meeting culture where everyone just shares what they're doing, what they're going on to next, and like what their blockers are, and how if you've not done that before, it might be a little bit awkward because people have this massive fear of sharing that they have a problem because they feel like they do need to solve it themselves, and it's a reflection on their ability when it's not. And actually, as soon as you voice that you do have a problem, 9 times out of 10, someone else is like, I've had that similar problem.
And
it can just, like you say, create that culture of trust, bring more heads to the game, different perspectives. I think people do massively undervalue that. It's a simple thing to implement. It's hard in terms of, like you say, managing personalities, managing people's egos, allowing people to see that they still are, they might not be the hero, but they're the expert. So that's still their domain of expertise, and people will still reach out to them for those parts. But, you know, bring more of yourself to the team so that we can go further.
I think it's challenging because it goes against a lot of what your natural instinct is, right? Your natural instinct is to fix it, to take care of your own thing. And so, yeah, it's sharing a bit of vulnerability when you do that, which is, it's hard, but that's part of trying to build up the trust of a team. And
yeah,
you know, we go through that same thing on a regular basis. I mean, our monthly cadence has all those aspects, right? We're a full agile shop, and that is part of the journey we've been on is getting that openness, getting the sharing out there, and making sure the communication stays intact, because we do, so we do monthly builds. We would never be able to get out a monthly build if we were not in constant collaboration and communication. So while no one likes a ton of meetings, there's a lot of touch points that are required in order to keep a global team functioning and moving at that pace not falling off the tracks. So we do a lot of that. And for example, we bring everyone together. In fact, just before this this podcast, we had our, what we call our weekly scrum of scrums, where we bring all the teams together once a week. Mm-hmm. And our engineering program manager goes from top to bottom of all of the deliverables that are in this release. And we look at everything that's a blocker, everything that's collectively going on top to bottom. And we can all understand, okay, where are we on the map for this month in terms of our release progress? Are we going to make it? Do we have challenges? Where do we need to push or pull? And then we kind of all disperse off of that. And then the teams will do their daily stand-ups and all of their individual planning, but at least once a week, there's always a touch point for everybody to know collectively where we are. And that kind of helps keep us on track at least.
Yeah, I think that's so useful. I think it can help with it. Once you understand what other teams are dealing with, what they're up against, what their responsibilities are, what they're trying to achieve that month, when you then need to go to that team for something, you have a much better understanding of what they're dealing with. You're probably going to have better empathy for them, and therefore you will probably approach them in a maybe just a kinder way than you would have if you're just like, hey, I need this, which is fine as well, because we don't have time. Sometimes I open up an email, and this has been so true during this COVID-19 disaster and everything else that's going on in the world. And sometimes I will open up an email and I'm just like, I need this, or I need that, or do you have an update on this? And I stop and I have a little think about, okay, maybe we should just say something nice. Now, you don't need to do that all the time, but just having that little appreciation or thinking about the last time you spoke to that person or what was going on, I think can go a long way, especially like you say, when you're dealing with teams that have different cultures and will just naturally communicate in different ways. The more you can bring them together and you can hear how they speak, they interact in the team meeting, etc., the more you can see that or hear that, then you will have a better understanding when you get an email that's maybe not how you would write an email.
One-to-one relationships are the key, right? It's really easy to make assumptions when you're thinking of an entire team or entire group, but when you start to get a couple people together one-to-one, it changes, and then people start to realize, who you are and okay, these people really, you know, this person has a lot of value. This person's smart. I can partner with them. It's just, but it's a journey. It's one of those just challenges of the role. So,
yeah. So, okay. So let's go through what a monthly cycle looks like. So
talk
a little bit about how you guys operate on a weekly basis, but how, what does a monthly cycle look like?
All right. So I'll break it down for originally, just like a lot of groups in Dell, we will sit down at the beginning of a program increment and do our PI planning.
Yep.
And that's typically for about a 3-month period. We'll plan out what our releases are going to look like. So 3 releases within an increment. And that is us sitting down with program or product management and looking at what are the business needs, what are the features, what are the things that they want to achieve for AfterStack Hub. And as you can imagine with a newer product, a lot of it is focused on innovation. Like, what can we add? What can we do? What can we build? So there's been a lot of that over the past 3 years. It was very much add feature, so that we could get ahead of the competition and get a leg up and have some things that no one else had, which was great. So we'll sit down and we will take all the things that they've kind of put at us, and we'll have had plenty of discussions before we really sit down into planning.
Yeah.
But at planning, we will build really what comes down to like a Kanban board. If you've heard of Kanban, it's another agile type of principle, but it's really very simple. We use Jira as our main tool, and we'll break up the weeks. So our sprints are 2 weeks at a time. So we know that there are 2 sprints in every release, and we build slots, and then we start to allocate the different deliverables into slots throughout the weeks. And part of what we do in the planning session is assign points and sprint points. They're really just increments of time. So when we allocate points, we know how much time and what the cost is of doing something. And we also know, obviously, the cost of that versus what our capacity is. So we look at our capacity and we look at how much can we allocate over a given release. And then there's always a massage of give and take. Okay, are we undersubscribed here? Are we oversubscribed here? How do we make this all fit together like a puzzle? And at the end of our planning, we've laid out what the next 3 months essentially look like in a perfect world, and product management understands it. We're all kind of aligned. This is what the deliverables are. Then we start sprint 1 of our first release cycle. And as it goes, typically the teams will get together. They will do their daily stand-up and sprint planning. They will work through any of their blockers and impediments and things like that. They'll start to prioritize based on what the board says. And then, like I mentioned earlier, once a week, we'll get together as a collective group, do our scrum of scrums. We also do a weekly bug bash, if you will, where we start to look at all the bugs that have piled up and make sure that they're getting proper attention, make sure they're categorized properly. And then anything that's come in from the field, because obviously we do have things in the field, we do have things that bubble up, we will evaluate those as well. And then depending on the severity of those, we need to adjust our work priorities. So sometimes we may need to prioritize fixing a certain bug higher than another feature. Or we can say, okay, we sometimes will reclassify a minor bug as something that's not really a bug, but more of a feature request for a future release. And we'll massage it that way so that we always have kind of a running list of current stories and bugs, and our board is updated accordingly. Teams will continue to kind of do their work through their sprint cycle. We have lots of just casual touch points with development, platform, everything. And then during that monthly cycle, as I mentioned earlier, builds will come in from Microsoft. So we're doing the evaluation of Microsoft code while we're doing some of the evaluation of our own code. So early on in the month, essentially, all of the software development happening in-house is being tested functionally by, we have quality engineers embedded with development. We also have kind of a what we call system integration test, which is a next level of testing built into our organization. Mm-hmm. So that kind of test cycle is going on continually. We'll do weekly demos for our product managers. So we have kind of this endless feedback loop. So, that's one of the main, as someone who's been living agile for a while now, that's one of the main tricks and tips is ensuring that there's this constant feedback loop with product management and product ownership. If you get too far away from that process or too far away from them, you will find that you take a lot of risk in deviating from the path, I guess is the best way to put it. You don't want to spend a lot of time developing something that missed the mark, because the whole intention of Agile is to be able to do small course corrections without a lot of cost.
Yeah.
So we do all of this interaction during our kind of, you know, weekly, bi-weekly conversations. Product owners are sitting right there with development. So there's just a lot of frequent touch points, not necessarily sit down meetings, but lots of frequent touch points. And then through these product demos, we will get real feedback on what hit the mark, what missed the mark, what's still outstanding. And that rolls back into the scrum of scrums call every week, and we kind of adjust accordingly. Now, there's a lot of managing change throughout the cycle, right? So what we put on the board is ideal, but I don't know if I've ever seen one come out ideal. So inevitably there are curveballs, whether it be something that we're building upon, say APIs we need to leverage from a product don't work as expected, or we didn't plan for this. The behavior we're getting from this component is not as we thought it would be. We need to dig in, or we need to leverage another Dell team or a shared service for more information. Well, not every Dell team is going to drop everything for your Azure Stack hub release in 2 weeks, right? So we have to manage the priorities accordingly. So if we know something's going to be delayed, we can pull it out. We can slot something else in on the board, and we can move something around within that 3-month program increment. We try to be as flexible as possible. And the main kind of slogan is the train never stops. So our release train always leaves the station every month. It's just a question of what's on the train. And that's typically okay. It can be a little hard for the folks that have come from the waterfall world or subscribe to just the OLP processes. That's a tough concept to sell initially, but that is the only way to ensure that we keep the Agile fundamentals moving, because as soon as you start to delay your releases, you're going to end up with one release every 3 months.
And that's just not going to work for this kind of product.
Now you're waterfall.
Yeah. You'd rather, I love that. I absolutely love the release train. That's brilliant. And the thing is that I was thinking about that as you were talking. I was like, but every month, like, you do have to, whether it's just Microsoft or, you know, whether we're doing our own thing or whatever, I was like, you do have to do, there's updates every month. Like, you don't have the choice not to do that. I mean, I imagine that you could.
But you do, but you don't. Like, you can not update, and then you can fall out of support, and then the best you're going to get is support on just getting you patched, right? Yeah. Like, that's really, and that's not ideal, because when you're facing a real problem, you don't want to hear run these 50 updates, because that's not a comfortable place to be, nor does that fix your problem necessarily.
Yeah. And so it's better that release train leaves with something of value than it backs up for months and then then it's a nightmare. So you'd rather have, you know, that train leaving every month over a period of like, say, two, three months, and have it eventually deliver what you need it to deliver, then hold it back because you can't all deliver it in this sort of typical waterfall fashion of like about 3 months. I love that. Way back in the day, I was a bid and project manager, and I didn't do prints. I did APMP stuff, and then I never got the chance to do Agile, but I was always a fan of that. And it's interesting because people would always say Agile is the answer, and then they try and implement it, and they tried to implement it in some companies that I've been involved in that just does not. You can't just, you know, it's like that. Here's a new tool or here's a new buzzword. Let's just bring this in and solve it all. But like we've just spent the majority of this podcast talking about is it needs to fit the use case. It needs to fit the team. It needs to fit the business, needs to fit being able to do Agile.
I can tell you this, and this for anyone who is embarking on Agile or thinking about it. No matter what company you work in, you're typically going to run into some challenges, because what you read in the books is great and it's all really good theory, but in practice, there's always trade-offs and nuances. And you can imagine in Dell, there's not a lot of agile teams in Dell, to be perfectly honest. There just aren't a lot. So we have done a lot of work as Trailblazers trying to make shared services core teams adapt and understand to how we need to do things. Because processes are not set up for that. OLP process is not set up for that. So I've spent a lot of time talking to whether, give you a great example really quick, the quality management. Every group in Dell essentially gets managed on quality, number of bugs, defects. Well, when you're talking about number of bugs and defects over a 30-day period versus, say, a six-month period, it differs wildly. And when you're doing percentage calculations, it doesn't work with Agile like that. So we've had to have groups re-kind of engineer how they calculate things, how they evaluate us in order to kind of match Agile. But what I'll tell everybody is this, is it's absolutely a journey, and it shouldn't be expected that you can roll in, pull open the book to whatever page and just implement. It does not work like that. And we're multiple years in on this, and I'm constantly pulling levers and tweaking knobs. And that's fun. That's part of the fun of it, but it'll never be done. Like, there's always going to be parts, and it needs constant evaluation, but we've been successful getting code out the door on a regular monthly basis. We've been able to stay relatively in concert with Microsoft. It's a challenge, just like doing waterfalls a challenge. There's constant kind of managing developer burnout. You don't want to burn your engineers out. This agile process, I after doing it for a while, I can see that there's a risk there of burning people out, because starts again. The cycle starts again. You start to feel like you're doing Groundhog Day sometimes. So trying to find ways to break it up for your developers, finding, you know, we always do a small 2 to 3 week break in between our increments to try and let people do some introspection.
I was just going to ask about that, because actually, as you were talking, I was like, oh my God, you guys are always on. Like, it's literally 2 weeks.
It feels that way. It does.
Yeah. 2 weeks up against the timeline every 2 weeks. Yeah. So do you rotate people out or get them to work on other stuff?
We don't. So right now we don't really rotate people out. What we do is there was always a 2 week, what we call IP sprint, which was between, it always ended up at the end of that last release of those 3 months, you'd have 2 weeks off. And then we would, in the middle of that, we would do our PI planning. And then at the end of that 2 weeks, you'd start the cycle again. The challenge to that was that 2 weeks got eaten up a lot by just things that needed to be cleaned up. It never ended up being the true, hey, go take a class, go read a book, go learn some things, or go clean up, you know, just things you didn't get to do. I've been much more strict about trying to make sure we have that time, and we've actually expanded it to 3 weeks. We're trying to be more stringent about adhering to our capacity, because that's the other thing, you know, as an agile, when you're asked to take on all these deliverables, you do your best job at estimating, but our estimates are not always right. So you may often find that you've absorbed more work than you plan to, or just because of the unforeseen changes, this took twice as long. So trying to ensure that you respect the fact that you have to give your engineers this break period, this time. It's not free time, but it certainly gives them a time to kind of break the cycle and then start again. It's still a challenge. It's always going to be a challenge, because you're allocating people's time down to the day. So there isn't a lot of buffer time built in, but it's something I continue to work on, and I'll probably find new tips and tricks the longer I do this. Is what my guess is.
I think it's something that you will always work on.
Yeah, it's like a constant.
It's a constant getting better, like you say, tweaking, pulling the levers, etc. I feel like Agile is the cloud of the project management world, just like cloud is cloud of the like IT infrastructure world.
It's a good way to look at it, because like I said, there's not a lot of people doing it well.
And it requires that total culture shift that cloud does, like the whole you saying about quality and the KPIs, and then needing to really think about actually how do we rethink this to actually get a read on the quality using this methodology. It's just like the same with like cloud when you know, CFOs will be like, why are we not using the cloud? I've heard that it's cheaper. And then everyone's like, okay, cool, we'll use the cloud, and we'll need to move from CapEx to OpEx, and we'll need to, you know, it's pay as you go. Well, right. can you please estimate what I'm going to spend every year? And it's like, well, I can give you a rough estimate of what we're, you know, going to use. And then they're like, oh, I can't handle that. And it's like, you have to change.
It's a mind shift.
Yeah, it's a mindset shift, and it's a whole new way of thinking if you want to reap those benefits. So yeah, that's my takeaway from this.
There's a lot of books, there's a lot of great information on it, and I don't claim that we do it perfectly, but we've certainly adapted to what we need to do within Dell to operate with Agile. And I think that's the trick, is finding, understanding your company's culture. Big companies have big culture, and so there's certain things you have to adapt to. Startup company, maybe not so much.
Yeah.
But no matter what, it's just, you have to have your kind of finger on the pulse. It's not a set it and forget it type of thing. But it does allow us to do a lot of things we wouldn't have been able to do with Waterfall. So there's a lot of benefit to it. But it's a challenging environment. But it also is what makes it fresh and fun. So I do enjoy it. And it's a constant learning environment, which is great.
Yeah, it sounds it. That has been super interesting. Like, because I kind of thought, you know, the co-engineering aspect with Microsoft, partner outside our family, the fact that you would need to integrate with other product teams within Dell, the fact that you had to, like, build it from scratch, but then, yeah, coming in and using, like, a methodology such as Agile that really isn't used a lot, and then having to interact with teams that do not use Agile, and therefore you would have had to do a lot of selling the dream, right, of Agile and explaining why you maybe needed to interact with different teams. That's congratulations and well done, Chris.
Well, thanks. We're still on the journey, but
congratulations to the Azure Stack Hub engineering team. That's what I want to say after the end of this podcast. Absolutely brilliant. I already knew that we were like a step ahead above the rest in terms of like just the thought process that we put in from the beginning about this. And I think that is a really important thing. Like, we really understood and had the people that understood what Azure Stack Hub was, thought about it in that cloud mentality, and then built from there up. You know, I think maybe creating this little, you know, this like startup team helped that, because we didn't sort of go into it thinking how we've done everything else before, because that wouldn't have worked.
The culture, it like you're saying, the culture was right from the start in terms of the vision for the product, and I don't take credit for that, but it was put on the right path to start in terms of what we had a vision for Dell EMC and Dell's solution for this. We made much bigger investment in engineering than our partners did initially, and that allowed us to have a lot of trust built up with Microsoft in terms of that deep engineering relationship. We put as much into it as anybody. And so there's a trust there, and there's a respect there, which I think has helped us been successful in our relationship with them. So when we're working a tough problem or a tough customer, they know us, and we've got, you know, we've got some clout built up with them, which is nice. But we were fortunate to have been in that incubation mode and kind of left alone, which allowed us to get where we were. And then, like I said, now it's a bit of integration with the general population, if you will.
Yeah, that incubation builds in the right culture, the right foundations, the right teams. And then that, you know, you've got that, you can then strongly go to the rest of Dell and the resources and begin to capitalize on that as well. Yeah, that's, do you know what, really excited about where we're going to go the next year or so.
I think we've got some good things on the horizon for sure.
Yeah, I can hear that across the street someone is beginning to play bagpipes. So I doubt that it will leak into the podcast and that you'll be able to hear it, but it's probably a sign for us to wrap up.
they're playing us off? Okay.
I've heard so many bagpipes playing in the last couple of months than I have ever done before. It's been really nice though.
That's cool. We don't have as many here.
But no. Well, thank you so much for your time, Chris. I really appreciate it and I really enjoyed the chat. And hopefully we'll speak again soon.
Thank you so much for having me, Lisa, and have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
All right, take care.